Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. In this episode of Real College Podcast, we'll be focusing on language and communication as we go on a journey to understand human interpersonal relationships. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, language is defined as the words, their pronunciation, and the methods of combining them used and understood by a community. For our purposes, we can just think of language as the way in which we spread information amongst ourselves, whether written, spoken, or texted, it's all the same. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, Language Edition, we discover the benefits of learning a second language, take a dive into immersion language learning here at the U, hear from our multilingual gophers here on campus, reflect on the power of the written word, discuss if Minnesota should have an official language, and an extra special installment of Radio K Sports Hour. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Although many of us here at the University of Minnesota are required to take a second language, the benefits of learning a second language go far beyond the academic. Here is reporter Casey Salazar with more.
If you take a walk down Lake Street, you will find yourself indulged in the Latino community with bakeries, taquerias, grocery stores, and more. And well, if you go down to University Avenue, then you'll find yourself in the middle of the Hmong community. And if you feel a little more adventurous, you can travel to Cedar Riverside, where you'll find yourself surrounded by the Somali culture. But what do these three communities have in common besides residing in the Twin Cities? Well, it turns out that here in Minnesota, Spanish, Hmong, and Somali are the top three languages spoken after English, according to the 2018-2019 enrollment data from the Minnesota Department of Education. For some, including myself, we are born into a culture where it is expected of us to learn the language, but for others, learning a second language is optional. This led me to explore the question, why learn a second language?
There are so many personal benefits that come from knowing another language well.
This is Professor Diane Tedek, a professor in second language education here at the University of Minnesota, whose expertise are in bilingual and language immersion education. Professor Tedek tells us what are some of the personal benefits of learning a second language.
You have social connection. You have this unique opportunity to communicate with a wider range of people in their personal and professional lives. You have greater perspective. Speaking another language really empowers us to access information that otherwise would be off limits. So I frequently in my work use Google in Spanish because I can. Watching a program that is developed in Spanish, being able to watch it in Spanish, is very different from watching a program and reading subtitles in English.
Another aspect that Professor Tedek talks about is how another language can make us more open by broadening our perspective, making us more understanding and appreciative of other cultures and less fearful of others.
I think that monolinguals have a tendency to be very fearful of other, and that causes a tremendous amount of damaging behaviors, I would say, in the U.S. I mean, hate crimes and so on, often because they don't understand the other.
Additionally, learning a second language has cognitive benefits too.
When we're born, our brains are wired for languages, but there's a number of studies that have shown that bilinguals outperform monolinguals in a range of cognitive and social tasks using both verbal and nonverbal tests. There's this part of the brain that points to cognitive flexibility. We have superior ability to concentrate, to solve problems, and to focus. We have better mental flexibility, and we are better multitaskers than monolinguals.
Lastly, one of the most popular reasons why someone would want to learn a second language is the job opportunities.
A lot of this comes from Patricia Gandara's work, and they have found that it really makes a difference when it comes to an individual who is a high-use bilingual, that is, they use both of their languages frequently for personal and professional reasons. And they're also highly biliterate. So when an individual is highly bilingual, uses both of their languages frequently, and they're highly biliterate, that's when it makes a difference. That's when we know that they have more career advancement opportunities, they earn more money, and so on. So again, another reason to actually build strong bilingual skills if you want to benefit from what they can bring you.
These are all amazing benefits people gain when learning a second language. But I wanted to know, why would someone personally pick to learn another language? So I talked to the U of M Spanish and Portuguese Department Ambassador, Michaela Korn, a third-year student here at the U who is working on a dual degree in Spanish studies and kinesiology with a minor in health and wellness promotion. Michaela shares why she decided to learn Spanish.
So my abuelo, his parents came from Mexico and they immigrated here to the U.S. And then they kind of just told my grandpa and his siblings that, you know, you're just going to speak English here. So the language kind of got lost between the generations. So then my uncles and my mom actually have been trying to learn Spanish and some are fluent. And then my mom speaks very minimal Spanish. So I wanted to kind of just be able to connect with my culture as well as just be able to communicate with a lot of different people.
Michaela expresses her love for learning languages. Not only she has learned English and Spanish, but she is also in the process of learning French and relearning sign language. What is her passion for learning languages?
I think it kind of just has to go with my passion for helping people. It's just something that I feel like is natural for me. Just all of a sudden it's just there and it comes easily to me, and I want to be able to communicate with others and I want to be able to understand them as well. So being able to communicate with them in their language and being able to understand them is probably what I think very beneficial for them as well as myself, because how cool is it that you can communicate with like many different people from many different places.
So Michaela, why struggle and challenge yourself to such a difficult task to learn a second language?
I sometimes question why. I'm just like, why am I still doing this? But I know my end goal, that I just want to be fluent and I want to be able to communicate with others and just travel around the world and be able to like actually know what I'm doing.
Although Michaela was exposed minimally to Spanish at home due to her mom, it wasn't until middle school where she formally started learning Spanish. Michaela expressed how different her life would be if she wouldn't have learned Spanish.
I've traveled to Puerto Rico and I've been to Spain 3 times. So it really like motivated my passion for traveling. So without Spanish, I feel like I'd be a little bit more boring, maybe not as passionate about different things.
Personally, I had no choice then to learn Spanish, but others like Michaela decided to learn Spanish. Why should people learn a second language?
I think it's very important, especially like I said, like in today's society, I think we're naturally like nomadic people. So people are going to be traveling everywhere, living in different places. And I feel like it's just important to interact with other people as well, like just learning a language and understanding them and their culture. And I wish that it wasn't just immersion schools that most connection with language. I wish that we kind of started to get to learn or have the option to learn languages when we were younger within the public schools, because then maybe we just have more understanding for different cultures.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Casey Salazar.
Learning a second language is not an easy task, and there are a variety of approaches to getting the task done. In this segment, we will hear from Emma Morris as she explains one popular technique for learning a language that is employed here at the U. Here's Emma with more.
When thinking about a piece for this episode, I thought back to the fall semester. I decided to pursue a major that now required me to take a language. So I decided, why not take French? You took it in high school for 2 years. How hard could it be? But boy, was I shocked. I got to my first class, and everything was in French. The course calendar, tasks we needed to complete, and the entire course was spoken in French, of course, despite being a beginner's course. This is what is called immersion learning, where you are placed directly in the environment in which you are learning. It is most commonly used in learning foreign languages. But what makes it so effective when used for language learning? This way of learning allows one to fully, well, immerse themselves in not only the language being learned, but also the culture, current events, and politics of the place or places it is spoken. Not only does this learning teach you about the language, it also helps your brain. Language learning increases both critical thinking and problem-solving skills, and it can even help you with language comprehension in your native language. So, if you have some space in your schedule, consider taking up a new language. For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
Here at the University of Minnesota, we have a diverse population of very intelligent students with many different disciplines. In an effort to sample the population and help Radio K discover how many languages are spoken here on campus, reporter Max Kalber took to the streets for this next segment of the podcast. Here's Max with more.
Hi, I'm Max Kalber, and I was on a mission to find out how many students at the U of M speak multiple languages. Subjects were asked how many languages they spoke and how they learned each one. Here's what I found outside Kauffman Memorial Union.
I speak three languages. English I learned in my education system. Hindi is my native language, and Urdu is something that we speak, but I cannot read Urdu. So it's a blend of Hindi and Persian. So these are the three languages I know and I speak.
I speak quite a bit of French. I grew up in Quebec, so that's a French-speaking part of Canada. And so I learned that through school and just being around French-speaking people. And then I've learned some Turkish through, a lot of it was through like Duolingo, the online language learning platform. I'm learning some Hebrew right now. I do that on Duolingo, and I've used other methods like listening to scripture and things like that, but trying to learn modern spoken Hebrew. And I can dabble in a few other languages like Greek, and I took Arabic in a classroom setting in Egypt, so I picked up some Arabic, but I'm not fluent. I can sort of pronounce words and things, but
I can speak three languages, English and a little bit of Spanish, from interacting with people that are like Spanish speakers in this country, and then going to Costa Rica and things like that. And then El Salvador on like mission trips, and also working in restaurant industry here. And then I can speak in tongues. Tongues is a name for, do you know what tongues is? So tongues is, it means languages. It's a Bible word. It means like, there's like a spiritual language that God gives us as a gift from the Holy Spirit. And it's a language that usually is only known by God. So that I don't even know what I'm saying when I speak it. But I pray and I sing in tongues, and then God, the Holy Spirit, and the Father, they kind of, and the Holy Spirit's interceding for me and building me up my faith and doing all sorts of amazing things and declaring the wonders of God in this. Something you might consider it, that it's called the tongues of angels, and so it's a prayer language that anyone who believes in Jesus can pray in. And that was my creative addition.
I only speak English, so one language.
I speak two languages. I'm from China, so I speak Chinese, but I learn in the United States, so I can speak little English, but it's not good.
I don't know how many languages I speak. I speak Chinese, Mandarin, Korean, French, and English. Well, Mandarin is my mother tongue, and then I learn English. I don't know, just kind of the way I grow up from very young. And then I learned Korean by myself, just like watch a lot of stuff. And I just started learning French in the U, so.
Incredible diversity, exactly the response I'd hoped for. Shout out to our interviewees, Emmanuel, Paul, Parnell, Ian, Jackie, and Rachel. Thank you for your contributions. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, this is Max Kalber signing off.
Most languages have two forms, the spoken form and the written. While spoken language allows for the instantaneous transmission of information between two or more individuals, the written form possesses a unique ability to transmit and capture information across a geographic location and time to an audience of an untold size. One local organization that has been using the power of the written word to create real-world change is Cow Tipping Press, a Minneapolis-based publishing company that is changing the narrative surrounding developmental disabilities. To celebrate their most recent work, I was graciously invited to attend a Facebook Live event by the program director at Cow Tipping, Rachel Lieberman. Rachel announced their newest work as well as explained the mission of Cow Tipping Press.
Hey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome.
Hello.
Hey. What's up?
We are here with authors from L'Arche Atlanta, excited to share with you our new book, My Beloved Son of a Gun. This is a really exciting class for Crowdsipping Press. It's our first out-of-state class brought to you by COVID-19 and Larch Atlanta. And Crowdsipping, for those of you who are tuning in and don't know, we are an organization based in Minnesota working to change the narrative on developmental disability in practice and in print. So one way we do this, we teach creative writing classes and publish work by adults with developmental disabilities, and we get those stories out to new audiences.
Based out of Minneapolis, the classes were taught by Jake Hoffman, a student at the University of Minnesota. Here is Jake explaining how the classes work.
My name is Jake. I am a student at the University of Minnesota, but I've also been the teacher for these beautiful authors here. Over the past few weeks, like Rachel said, we've been teaching creative writing classes, genres varying from creative, nonfiction, fiction, poetry, drama, and then a free write at the end. So it's been a blast. We've all gotten really close. We're far away due to COVID. I'm in Minneapolis, everyone else is in Atlanta, but we've had a lot of fun, connected with a lot of awesome people, and made a lot of new friendships. So yeah.
During the event, the authors read their pieces aloud for the audience. Author Amber Magwood started off the expose by reading her piece, Mrs. Mew Mew.
Mrs. Mew Mew by me. A yellow, small, talking cat that lives in outer space until she lives in planet Earth as her new home. She has extraordinary powers such as high intelligence, turn her paws into hands, and unlimited body strength. After years of spending time on Earth, she learned more on humans and their civilization. Her goal is to make humankind a better place. She doesn't want anyone to know she's a cat, so she kept it anonymous to save the day.
Just like Jake said, the authors covered all their bases, from short stories to poetry and prose. The authors drew inspiration from the pandemic in many instances, like in Grant Talley's piece, COVID-19 Treatment.
Good morning, America. The COVID-19 vaccine is still keeping going, and it's important to make sure you stay healthy and make sure everything will go right back to what it used to be.
The pieces ranged widely in their word choice and flavor, with some authors preferring comedy or lighthearted tales, while others employed suspense or horror. One thing they all had in common was tremendous power, demonstrated by Nick Papadopoulos' piece, Being.
My name is Nick Papadopoulos, and this is Being. Being a writer. Being an advocate for myself and others. Being an adventurer. Being a good man full of compassion. Being humorous, being inspiring, and being inspired, being thoughtful, being kind, being loving, being strong, being part of a community, being provoking and evocative. These are some of the things I strive to be.
After the exhibition, two of the authors stayed to chat with me, and one of them was Nick, who you just heard. Here is what Nick had to say about the Crowdsipping course.
Yeah, for me, so I don't know if you guys know, but I, for the past 4 years, I've been in a nursing home. And so stimulation here is very minimal. I mean, very minimal. So when I got the opportunity to join the workshop through Larch Atlanta, I jumped at it. And it was the best decision I ever made because it allowed me to flex my brain. And I haven't flexed my brain in about 4 years. So I felt great, you know, and it was great to be able to open my soul, because when I'm in here, I'm closed off. You know, I'm closed off from humanity, and I'm closed off from friendship, and I'm closed off from people. And being able to be part of the class, I have, you know, I get to express myself. I got to meet Jake. I got to meet all these cool new friends. I got to hear their stories. And most importantly, I got a chance to have a voice to tell my stories and to let myself, you know, breathe creatively for a little bit. And I'll always be grateful for that kind of opportunity and any others that come along.
The other author who stayed to chat was Ricardo Arandas. Ricardo emphasized the power the written language had when employed in the course to traverse physical space.
Jake and I talked about this earlier in the week, that for me, this really helped because honestly, it actually felt as if I literally, although this was virtually, it actually felt as if I were taking an actual virtual trip up there to Minneapolis, where Caltipping Press is and where Jake is. So I felt like I was just literally there with you all for 5 weeks. That's why, you know, the writing piece, that last final writing piece that I wrote is the way it is, because it was just my experience of what I saw, of what I felt, and how I, you know, experienced the course in my perspective, which for me was absolutely fantastic. I mean, like I said in the piece, I'm leaving here not just with new friends, but with family.
Ricardo went on to explain the logistics of the class and how it operated on a weekly basis.
So the classes went kind of like this. So every week we would all get together, and there'd be this recurring theme that Jake would very beautifully introduce in the form of a vocabulary word. He'd give us a vocabulary word for the day or for the week. I don't know if it was for the day or for the week, but I digress. And then once he gave us the word and then the definition and then kind of explained it to us, just in layman's terms. And then there would be, for the first few weeks, there were these readings. There were these really cool and really interesting readings, or he called them readings, but there were actually works that he would read out loud to us. And then we would have one of the readings, and then he would give us a prompt based on that reading. We would go into breakout rooms and write a piece based on whatever the theme or whatever the prompt or prompts would be for that week. For instance, for the poetry, we wrote, you know, all the different forms of poetry. For the creative writing, we wrote, you know, that's where the Lost in Space stories came from. And yeah, all the things of that sort.
Ricardo reminisced on his highlights and favorite moments from the course, as well as underscored the power of the written language.
For me, my favorite prompt was within the poetry section, and Jake can attest to this. Within the poetry section, there was one of the poems is actually called the type of poem it is. It's a list poem where the poet, the author, literally just lists a list of things, and just, you know, some list poems have a rhyme scheme. Some list poems don't. And based on that, my favorite piece that I heard in the class was a poem by a poem called Thanksgiving. I loved it so much that I even asked Jake to send it to me because I loved it so much. I mean, with all that's going on in the world, and, you know, with the virus and everything, for me and for people like us, but especially for me, being home for a year, being, you know, isolated for a year with just my family, things can be and seem kind of scary. Very, very, very scary, especially, you know, since I have a visual impairment and you know, I have cerebral palsy as well. That poem was just very, very comforting for me.
Nick echoed Ricardo, as well as reflected on his piece that you heard earlier.
The part that was my favorite was the part where we created our very own dramatic story. Like we had, so Jake had broken it up into three parts, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And so that was where I kind of wrote my murder mystery. And then, you know, those are the things that I love to write, you know, things that keep the reader on edge. And so I took great pleasure in reading that. And the way he had it structured, you know, it wasn't overwhelming at all. It was very easy. Like, you know, I got to write the beginning for 15 minutes, the middle for 15 minutes, and then the end for 15 minutes. And then it all came together and it was just beautiful. And so I like that. And then very much. And then I echo Ricardo's comment about the list poem where I wrote Being, because that poem was very special to me personally. When I came into the class, I felt that I was no good at writing poems at all. And I kind of surprised myself with what I created when I wrote Being. So, you know, it was a pleasure.
Ricardo emphasized why he thinks Caltipping Press is so important.
I do this for inclusion. I do this for to support people with disabilities. And as John Lewis said, get into trouble. good trouble, necessary trouble.
Before he let me go, Ricardo imparted this farewell message to you all.
I just want to give one final public thank you, not just to Cal Tipping Press, but also to Radio K and the University of Minnesota, all of the faculty and the staff that was instrumental in putting this thing on to help us, as I said in the piece, to help us find our voices and to help us continue the work of inclusion that we're already undertaking. Thank you, boys.
Thank you to Ricardo and all of the authors at Cal Tipping Press for graciously sharing their time and art with all of us. If you would like to check out their book, My Beloved Son of a Gun, it is available now for purchase on Amazon for only $5.99 and features all of the pieces you heard in this podcast and more. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. Although the two are inextricably linked, language and culture are not the same thing. In this segment of the podcast, we will hear from reporter Isaac Maruyama as he walks us through the debate surrounding Minnesota's official language and what happens when one confuses the two. Here's Isaac with more.
Minnesota, like 19 other states, does not have an official language. And while at first glance that might seem like a political non-issue, it's actually sparked serious controversy in the past. In 2011, current Minnesota State Representative Steve Drazkowski introduced a bill that would make English the official language of Minnesota. Similar bills were also introduced in 2007 and 2008, although all three have since died in committee. So why were these bills proposed in the first place? Well, to understand why some people support making English our official language, there are a few arguments you need to understand. First, it would cut costs of translating and printing government materials in different languages. Second, they claim that it would incentivize immigrants to learn English. And finally, it would help to unite the nation by assimilating immigrants into American culture. But according to critics of official English legislation, these arguments go against some of our most basic principles. Every American citizen has the right to participate in our democracy, regardless of which language they speak. And the idea of American culture being tied to the English language disregards the vast diversity of our population. According to the Migration Policy Institute, over one-fifth of Americans speak a language other than English at home. On the other side of the official English debate, some politicians are working to expand the number of languages supported by the government. Earlier this year, a bill was introduced to the Minnesota House of Representatives that would require voting instructions to be printed in other languages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. House File 158 is a simple bill, but it is important to our communities and to our democracy.
That's Representative Samantha Vang presenting the bill to the House.
The right to vote is granted to all citizens, but for some, exercising the right to vote is difficult, especially for communities with limited English. Thus, this bill is meant to improve language access at the polls. What this bill does is requires the Office of Secretary of State to prepare instructions for using in-person absentee voting, or also known as early voting, in languages other than English, and those instructions must be prepared at minimum Spanish, in Hmong, and in Somali languages, and maybe prepared in other languages too.
Now, if you're like 90% of Minnesotans and speak English as your primary language, having voting instructions printed in other languages probably wouldn't affect you all that much. But if you're an immigrant who doesn't speak English fluently, it can determine whether or not you have the ability to participate in the democratic process, as this testimony from one of the bill's supporters explains.
My name is Sahul Abdul Hali, and I live in Savage, Minnesota. I'm a mother of five, and I'm a cultural liaison for the Somali community in the 191 school district. For the last 3 years, I've been involved in helping families get out the vote by providing transportation and translation services. I've heard so many members of my community express their anxiety about voting for the first time. It is an intimidating process and a huge step, especially if you have limited English language knowledge and no one there to help translate, which we ran into a lot. I spoke with a few women who said they showed up to vote, looked at their ballot, and didn't understand what they were supposed to do. One of them was not a shy or nervous person, but when it came to filling out her ballot, she told me she was shaking and sweating and wasn't able to complete it. The lack of language resources leaves people feeling like no one cares about them and disincentivizes them to vote. We had to work so hard to convince people that their voice matters, that it's their right as an American citizen, even if they don't have the expert knowledge of the language. Yet when we showed up to polling locations, the resources were not available to guide them through the process. Instead, we helped them. They were so grateful when we explained the process to them. So many people finally felt like they had a say in the decisions that impact their daily life. However, we as a community members and volunteers can't be everywhere at once. We need to have language resources available to help our voters feel confident and proud of casting their ballot. Voting should be comfortable and welcoming experience for everyone. I support this bill in its effort to do that. Thank you.
As you've just heard, even though Minnesota doesn't have an official language, there's still a glaring lack of government resources available to those who aren't fluent in English. It's concerns like these that make it impossible to detach the push to make English our official language from the very real consequences that could occur if such legislation were ever to succeed. If right now it's difficult for some immigrants to participate in our predominantly English-based democracy, making English the official language would make it nearly impossible. That's what happened in 2010, when the city of Llano Lakes adopted English as its official language, approving a measure that prevented the local government from translating official documents into other languages. To give you some context, Llano Lakes is over 90% white, and at the time the measure was passed, nobody had ever asked them to translate their documents in the first place. On one hand, that might make it seem like the measure wouldn't hurt anyone, but on the other hand, it also means that there was no financial reason to pass it. That brings us right to the heart of the debate over whether or not English should be our official language. Is it really worth it to cut cost in an area where there's hardly any money being spent, when the results could make it so that many Minnesotans are unable to participate in our democracy? And on another level, what would making English our official language say about our society? The whole point of our nation is that we don't have a single ethnic or cultural identity, so it's easy to see why some people view the official English movement as thinly veiled anti-immigration sentiment. I found an old interview of Maru Mujica, the current chairman of U.S. English, which is the largest advocacy group dedicated to making English the official language of the United States. As an immigrant himself, he's adamant that making English the official language would help immigrants assimilate into American culture.
We were founded by Senator Hayakawa, who was a linguist and a semanticist, in 1983. Senator Hayakawa was himself an immigrant. He came to this country and he was very concerned that the country would be eventually divided along linguistic lines. We want the government to begin teaching English to immigrants and to help them assimilate, like Israel. Israel has a system called Ulpanim, is the plural of Ulpan. If you immigrate to Israel, they give you money so you don't have to work for 6 months. They send you to an Ulpan full time, and you learn how to be an Israeli, you learn how to speak Hebrew, etc. They help you assimilate.
U.S. English is careful to state that they do not support English-only legislation, and that their proposals wouldn't affect languages spoken at home or in the classroom. But they would still require that public documents, records, legislation, and regulations be written only in English. Personally, I find it hard to believe that essentially preventing non-English speakers from reading American laws is the most effective way to assimilate them into American society. And as anyone who's taken a foreign language course knows, learning a new language can be extremely difficult. For someone going through the many trials of immigrating to a new country, the least we can do is make sure that they have access to whatever information they might need in a language they can understand. It's clear that the debate over making English our official language is anything but over. If you speak English, it's easy to take for granted that you never have to worry about not being able to communicate with others and understand the world around you. So, the next time you hear about a proposal to either expand or take away access to government information in other languages, remember that there's a whole lot more to the issue that meets the eye, and that how we deal with languages in our nation says a lot about how we deal with each other. For Real College Podcast on Radio K, this is Isaac Maruyama.
Before this episode of Real College Podcast comes to a close, we will hear from Jason Ruttman with an extra special installment of Radio K Sports Hour. Take it away, Jason.
Language is crucial for our everyday success. It forms the baseline for communication that we use to interact with others every single day. It's even more important when you're a part of a team and need to be on the same page with others to achieve a goal. In sports, language serves not only to coordinate with your coaches and teammates to win games, but also to create a bond with those around you. I had a chance to talk with senior pitcher Ryan Duffy from the Golden Gopher baseball team. Here's what he had to say. Ryan, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. This week's RCP theme is language, so I thought we could keep the conversation pretty lighthearted to start out with. So, on that note, can you tell me what you and your teammates talk about when you're hanging out in the bus or the plane or when you have some downtime?
Yeah, so we actually keep it pretty away from baseball, just kind of joking around with everybody. It's kind of everywhere, the talking, but a lot of joking around, a lot of messing around, just having fun. And we really don't talk too much about baseball as a whole. And then just everyday stuff you'd encounter, just simple joking stuff and just poking fun at each other, trying to keep everybody loose, essentially.
All right. So on that same kind of vein about joking, if I were to ask you what the funniest locker room joke or moment you've ever been a part of was, do any memories come to mind?
There's probably quite a few that would come to mind. A lot of them pretty centralized around Patrick Fredrickson. He's a pretty funny, unique character. Just really not anything he specifically will say, just kind of his tone of voice. And then some of the stuff he does is just, it has made a lot of people laugh, and he's a fun guy to be around, definitely, for sure.
All right, that's great. So now, on a more serious note, communication in baseball is key for success. As a pitcher, you and your catcher have a way of communicating without talking to decide what pitch to throw, when to try and pick a runner off, when to do a pitch out, you know, et cetera. What can you tell me about that system and how it works?
Yeah, so probably can't go too in-depth on our sign system for pitches or anything like that, but simple things like a pitch out or a pickoff, pretty universal in all of baseball. A pitch out will be like a fist, just a straight fist, and you'll know that it's a pitch out. A pickoff, it's like a flick of the thumb, and that's pretty universal in all of baseball, pretty standard, which everyone uses. So that's kind of how we know that. There's different, depending on who you are, you have different keys that you can and tips on when you want to pick off, whether it's between you and the second baseman, you and the first baseman, just to let them know that it's coming over, things like that.
So you and your catcher have, you know, sign symbols with your hands. He'll flash, you know, a few fingers down at you to tell you what pitch to throw, maybe a motion with the hand to tell you to pick off. How long did that take for you guys to come up with and develop, camaraderie and quickness with it?
Yeah, it didn't take too long. For the most part, it's pretty universal. And then we made it a big emphasis on learning the sign system. So we had it down, because one of the worst things is when you cross up the catcher, you miss a sign, and then it's really self-inflicting, not very good. So it was a point of emphasis. So it didn't take too long because we did emphasize it so much, but it was different from high school for sure, because you usually don't need to worry about all that stuff in high school. But
how often are you getting signs from the dugout from Coach Anderson or your pitching coach?
I don't get any signs from the dugout. The catcher will get the signs and then relay them to me if he's getting certain signs, stuff like that.
Okay. And then I got one more question for you, Ryan. What's the best piece of baseball advice anyone has ever given you?
I think probably my high school coach said this to me, and it was just always, no matter what happens, make sure you still have confidence in yourself. Just because baseball is such a game of failure, and it's a tough game to learn and get used to. And failure is not always the easiest thing to deal with, but as long as I have confidence in myself, I'll be able to perform and do well on a consistent basis. And you just can't let it get to you when things aren't going your way, because it'll turn around quick if you keep that self-confidence. So,
are there any, you know, mental tips or tricks that you use when you're feeling a little less self-confident when you have a rough game?
Yeah, I have some verbal cues that I use. I will tell myself, like, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, just to slow down. in case if I'm getting out of sync or something like that, if the game speeds up. So just to slow myself down consciously and physically, just in order to get back to my cues, things like that. But
what role do your teammates play in, you know, helping you stay focused and slowing you down?
Yeah, I think some of them know the verbal cues I use, and then some of them just constant support from them is just huge, especially knowing that I can depend on them and they depend on me as well. So.
All right. Well, that's great. Ryan, thank you again for taking the time to speak with me. And I look forward to following you and the rest of Gopher Baseball as you continue your 2021 campaign.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
The Gophers have three games at Siebert Field against the Purdue Boilermakers this weekend. The first game is on Friday at 6 p.m. Make sure to tune in and support the Maroon and Gold.
That's all for the special edition language episode of Real College Podcast. Stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.